Okay, you guys, on this episode of the Outrun Show, we'll be talking about free gains. What is it? Where does it come from? What are these free gains? Free things you get? Everyone likes free stuff, so you should listen. Design in the new gym. We're coming to a point where we have to, like, kind of solidify some decisions. It can't just be so much of the abstract anymore. We have to make some tough choices. Mm-hmm. And it's one of our birthdays today. Find out whose it is on this episode of The Outrun Show. Okay, on this episode, we are talking about somebody's birthday on the team, as well as going mad from drinking too much milk. Can you go mad from that? Free gains, the concept of free gains. How can we earn extra dividends on our movements inside of parkour? Why Jesse's bales don't scare us? And what techniques could we be using that will give us the best return on effort? I'm Travis.
I'm Jesse.
I'm Justin.
And sure. Recently, one of us had a birthday. Let me correct that because the podcast drops in different days and whatever. That was Jesse's birthday. Was it Saturday?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Somewhat of redemption there. Mm-hmm. So what did you get for your birthday?
I got a bunch of different stuff, actually.
One of your gifts is here today, though.
Carly always jokes, although it's not so much a joke, and I'm very lucky to have her in my life, but she always jokes that her favorite holiday of the year is my birthday. It's very sweet. So I actually had, like, a whole weekend of plans. Mm. So, like, Friday, we went out for sushi and had the roulette roll. And don't worry, you weren't not invited. Mm. We just know that there are some things in your life right now that you're trying to protect. Given the context of COVID,
like getting a spicy sushi roll. I don't.
Yeah, and you also didn't want to do that.
Who got the roulette roll?
Lindsay got it.
Oh, nice.
The person who handles the least amount of spice out of all.
That's always the best. You don't want the person who can take the spice to get the roulette roll.
Yeah. So for those of you listening, every year for my birthday, we go out for sushi, and we all order sushi. We all eat, have a great time, and drink a little bit. And then the last roll that comes out is what we call a roulette roll, and it's. We pick whatever the roll itself is, but one of those rolls is spiked with a ghost pepper. And you can kind of determine the heat, but because, you know, we're Outrun, we go hard on her. And so we go the hottest that they can get, which is pretty unfortunate. And then you don't know which roll it is, so everybody picks one and puts it on their plate, and then we all eat at the same time. And then if nobody gets it on that round, we do a round two, on and on. Well, we got to round two. And nobody had gotten it. And then we all did the last round, and I had peer pressured Lindsay into doing another round because she said she was only going to do one. And she got it. And for about 30 minutes, she was just crying there at the table. What was the quote?
I need some oatmeal.
Wow, that Lindsay's is all.
Lindsay's a vegetarian, like kind of shifting towards vegan. So I asked that, you know, them to bring milk, and all they had was just regular milk. They didn't have, like, oat milk. But, so she was joking, and amidst tears and, like, a red face, she was like, do you have any oat milk?
No, it was serious. It wasn't even like, oh, that's so
She
funny.
Drank the milk, though, so, because the pain was that necessary.
I love that. That is such, like, a Colorado, like, Whole Foods
I know, right?
Thing. I need oat milk.
Amid, like, while suffering, while literally dying.
Yes.
You're like, maybe oat milk instead.
free range oats oats that ran free in the fields before their lives ended.
But yeah, Lindsay took it like a champ, though. Yeah. She did great. I had lost the previous 2 years in a row, so I was excited not to lose this year.
I forgot about that.
Yeah,
that is true.
So it's nice to share the pain on my birthday, also because it makes the birthday of my morning often pretty unfortunate.
Yep.
When I, you know, visit the bathroom.
Yeah.
So that's
you
nice.
Just need more of those free
not
range.
Travis
oats.
Has that.
Yeah. I don't.
He just hasn't destroyed his intestinal lining yet with enough spicy food.
I don't.
He grew up pretty, with our dad. In
I've had some
rush.
Definitely had spicy. Yeah, we used to do. Even after China's really spicy, and then Thai is really spicy. But we used to do the when I was getting really like nutty like health stuff. It's not nutty, you guys. It's okay. Like, I was into health
extreme.
Stuff. Extreme health. Well, I would only ride the free-range oats to dinner, right? Like that. We'd take the Thai peppers, and you have to bite a Thai pepper and then do a shooter with straight apple cider vinegar.
Oh.
If anything destroys your stomach lining, it would be like just straight apple cider vinegar.
Yeah. What actually destroyed my stomach lining was Mountain Dew. So if you're a kid, you're listening to this, I think it was the caffeine and the sugar. At least that's what the doctor said.
I'm telling you that I probably drank more Mountain Dew than you.
What?
And I just got cancer from it.
Okay.
Yeah. You just got like on the level of the amount of Mountain Dew. Travis got to cancer level, which is like a high score.
Oh, that's true.
Very you high just score. Didn't quite Skipped get ulcer. That. Yeah.
Right. You were just in like bronze.
Oh, I forgot. Yeah, you had that ulcer.
Because the ulcer is pretty good. That's at least silver.
Silver rank.
Silver rank.
Because I didn't have a problem with spicy food until I had my ulcer. And then I was like, it's just bad mornings.
Yeah,
bad
nights. Ironically, I feel like the better I eat, the weaker I am at like eating junk, right? So I think that.
It's because your body is like, gets angry.
It's like, cool, it's fine.
It recognizes, right? It's like when you're young and somebody's like, hey, if you, mow the yard, and the yard's like an acre and a half with a hand mower, I'll pay you $15. You're like, oh, sweet, yeah. And nowadays you're like, wait a second, that's practically slavery.
Yeah. Yeah. There's like acclimation. Like and yeah, it is. There's the, it's all context, right? Like you just.
Now you know better.
Now you know better. But now we do eat better. We eat really well. Like 80% of my shopping is probably at like Whole Foods, and next is like natural grocers. Every once in a while,
if you're at Whole Foods buying True Move friggin' chocolate milk, it don't really matter where you shop.
That's true. Okay, so when I say that,
Whole Foods
like,
don't sell no True Move, all right?
Dude, you're right. They probably charge you $7 for the same milk.
You get the True Move, which is like kind of like in this region is sort of like the cheapest like chocolate milk that you can
get.
It's a
gallon chocolate milk.
But it's so good because it's half sugar. Anyway, and they actually sell out the whole milk. Instead of that.
Yeah.
So hey, actually, what's the Promised Land? I do like
Promised
that
Land.
That brand's pretty good.
But they use the...
But let's be honest, it's just...
They use the brown cows. They use the brown cows. That's the difference. They're like...
Delude ourselves into thinking that there's anything real, real healthy about that Promised Land chocolate milk.
No, there's not. Okay, so we do love milk, but we also acknowledge that the dairy industry is an issue, and some of us have developed a bit of an intolerance for the milks. That's pretty.
GoMad broke me.
Yeah, GoMad have an effect. So GoMad was an earlier in like the CrossFit days. It was recommended to me, and this is like 2010 or something like that. That we do a this will make it on the highlights. That we do a mass gain. So I was trying to gain weight. So for you guys out there who are younger parkour athletes who are like kind of scrawny and you want to put some mass on, there's a shortcut, but it's very you pay the price and you can deal with the devil on that one.
You call that a shortcut?
Oh yeah.
I feel like that's the uphill battle.
Oh wow. Okay.
If you're a hard gainer, there's just it's in the name.
Willing.
It's so hard to gain weight as a hard gainer that you're willing at some point you're willing to just try anything.
So a hard gainer, so tips for hard gainers, because when you're a hard gainer,
hard gainer is muscle.
It's usually self-diagnosed as someone who can't put on weight.
Okay.
So it's someone who is like, they have a higher metabolism, they're younger, they just move a lot, and they don't
eat enough.
Most
parkour athletes would probably fall under like a hard gainer.
And some people will say things like, when you're younger, your metabolism is stronger. There's just truth to that. And you're doing a lot, you're growing a lot, and you're learning a lot, and you're probably training a lot. So when some people are like, well, I've got a kid, he's real skinny, but he can eat whatever he wants. Like, yeah, I mean, he's probably eating whatever he wants, but he's probably not putting the right kind of, like, calories in. Like, his calories are probably all Mountain Dew and Reese's Peanut Butter Cups, right? Like, that's not going to work to grow a body. And matter of fact, it may just make you feel hungry and a little bit, like they call it, like, binny. The like fat skinny, where it's like you would think someone would just be shredded. Yeah, you're like, but they're not. They're kind of doughy, but still small. And they're not body shaming that, but this is just the archetype of somebody who would say, I'm a hard gainer. They usually self-diagnose that way. But if they really just focus on a few things, maybe some of the lifts we'll talk about later on as we talk about those free gains, I would say a GoMad is not free gaining. So GoMad is a hack. It's a gallon of milk a day diet. So we've heard of all these diets before. This is a gallon of milk a day diet. And I did this diet. So it was when I was hardcore paleo, meaning I almost didn't have any carbs in my life except for like a sweet potato. And every once in a while I would look at a wild berry or something like that. Right?
Tater.
Dude, I was like 145. Well, at the end of the day, full on like steak, maybe I'd hit 150, and was pretty shredded. Probably the most shredded I've been in my life, but very, very small. And I was doing CrossFit, and a lot of the lifts were getting in the way. Like, I couldn't pick up much weight. And at that time, that was important to me. Tis not important to me now, but I wanted to lift more. So my coach was like, hey, yeah, well, you know, he's a former like military guy. He's like, well, you know, when I took kids through training and we were deployed and we were together and I had to put weight on kids really fast, I'd just be like, hey, just do the gallon of milk a day diet. And I was like, I can do that, because I'm very like, I may be flighty, but I'm like in the short term, very determined. And so I'm like, I can do that. I can make that work. And so I stayed paleo, which gave me like a foundation of like vegetables. So I wasn't just eating crap. It was like crap plus, it was like good food plus a crap gallon of milk a day. I bought the good quality milk, local dairy.
Got to.
And I literally would have to buy 5 gallons at once, because I just the way it rotated through, you'd have to like buy it on certain days. And I would start in the morning, and I would carry on a pint like at work, like a beer pint.
Oh, so you could, everyone knew you're drinking milk.
Yep. Yeah. And I knew my number, so yeah. I had to get
to. There's no way to hide it.
I had to get to. Oh, you can't hide consuming that much. And I had to get to 8 pints a day to get to a gallon. And so, or it might have been 9, I can't remember, right? 8 or 9. I'd carry it around, and I'd be like hash marking off like how I got through my milk. And yeah, gallon of milk a day, 2.5 months, went from like high 140s to low 180s in 2.5 months. That's the gallon of milk a day. Now, I've since had a few people try it. Now, I got a little bit addicted to milk after that.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you come off of it and you just start to itch. You're just like, where's that milk? Girl. You know, you're like, okay, I'm done. I don't have to do it anymore. And then you're like, but I kind of want to.
But just, you just like, just pictured the Mad Max milk scene in my head. Now I can't undo it.
Well, now you know why, like, little puppies and like little kittens, you know, they're just like, they just go ravenous over like when it's food time. And just,
milk. But it doesn't work with chocolate milk, even though you can throw some in every once in a while. Like, I would count a pint of chocolate milk as my, you know, one of the pints. But yeah, you would get. Really, like, I think I would have gained a ton of like fat if I hadn't been basically keto plus GoMad.
Yeah, that, like, if you're on GoMad, that's gonna be your only sugar,
right? You're getting. But the milk, it's made to turn little cows into big cows. It's filled with hormones, like the complex, the whole milk. This was whole milk. This is not skim milk. Dude, it's not.
It's thicky syrup.
For wild, sure, wild, free range oat milk.
It's made to make heifers.
Yep, yeah. It's made to make heifers, literally. And so, yeah, I will admit at the end of that, I was a little fluffy, but I still had some abs, and I think I cut right afterwards just by coming off of it and keeping my activity up. And then I hung out around like 175 for a while, 170, 175. And that was some of the best weight that I've been at, just for like training and doing work and stuff. I feel like maybe that's a little heavy for jumping. I think you kind of want to be lighter if you just want to jump, but overall, I was pretty happy at that weight. Mm. I do think that I got a little bit of insulin resistance issues from it, but yeah, no long-term repercussions that I can tell. When you're older, you don't want to do that. I did this, you know, I think I was just about 30 when I did it. You don't want to do it when you get older, because the hormones in milk can actually grow the prostate. So,
like, you just say your height. I was like,
oh no, it's that milk can make you tall. Yeah,
I feel like that was an ad.
So I'm somebody sure else,
Doug, there was an ad for that one.
Yeah, there was somebody else. Lies. in my squad did a dozen eggs a day, and that's an alternative one. That one, ooh, for me would be hard.
That one would be very hard.
Yeah, definitely healthier than straight a gallon of milk.
I would agree. So I totally think that the dairy industry is something that needs to be reined in. I don't like how it's advertised to everybody and how everybody feels like they have to consume it. But I am someone who is highly acclimated to be able to consume milk, evidently, because I can do it. So my ancestors somewhere. Like, that did not bother me that much. I take that lactase enzyme, the enzyme for that people take who are lactose intolerant. Pop one of those a day, every other day, I didn't have any problems. Yeah, what was your experience?
It was about the same. But I went into it intentionally, like, prepping. So I bought a box of those, like,
lactase.
Pills. And I wouldn't do it every day, but I would definitely, like, every other day, I'd probably take one or two of them, mm-hmm. Just to chase through. But it was rough.
Yeah,
it's tough, because you'll hear it suggested by like bodybuilders who are like, you know, a lean 180, and like, if you're a skinny 140, a gallon of milk feels a lot different on your body than it does his or hers at 180. I can guarantee you that. So like as a little guy, a gallon of milk, you know, 8 pounds is like, it's freaking one, you know, 1/4 or 1/14th of my body weight that I have to add on every day just in milk liquid.
Do you guys think that the Tyson chicken bag of the GoMad, if you think one would be the better option?
My alternate suggestion, definitely the milk, because you can control the quality of the milk. my alternate suggestion, though, was Pobad.
The more expensive option, right?
It's about the same. I guess it's probably a little bit more, but if you're getting like high quality gallon of milk, that's what, $6 a gallon.
Yeah, you're getting the high quality milk that you can't buy in one carton. They don't sell that.
They sell only in half.
In half full gallons.
Yeah.
Oh, I used to have that Morning Fresh deliver. So they come and they just show up. I had one guy at a grocery store.
It just makes that image worse now.
It's like the milkman shows up and he's like,
shows up and you're just like, oh, guess I get started.
Thanks, man. It's like he came to feed T-Rex or something. He's like, and says, put it on the tray. And I thought, oh gosh, he's going to grab my hand. The one time I did go to a grocery store and I just to buy 5 gallons of milk, and the guy at the who's sacking is like, huh, you gonna drink all this today? And I was like, one of them. I just gave him that like stare, and he was just like, what the hell? Yeah. But yeah, no, I'm off that now. And as far as free gains go, since that is one of the topics we're gonna touch on today. And that is, what is your, what things can you do, essentially, will bring back up a little bit of the milk? Or do you want to jump into it right now?
Yeah, let's go. I think we should get
on
to it.
So
someone needs to explain free gains.
So free gains is basically a concept that if you do one particular thing, you gain in a bunch of areas unintentionally. So, or maybe intentionally, but just by free, right? That's what's free. So if you go out and you do one thing, you get a bunch of other things. So for example, in GoMad, if you drink a gallon of milk a day, you could perhaps do the bacon, or the pound of bacon, that's what you're talking about.
Pobad?
The Pobad, right? Or you could do the eggs too, but you might not get the growth hormone that is naturally in milk, right? So you get the free gains of
growth hormone
in there. Okay, that's kind of the nutrition is a terrible example. Let's switch to training because that's where we're all understand. So if I do a back squat, I'm going to gain both anterior and posterior strength. Meaning if I do a high bar back squat and I go really deep in my squats, I'm going to work the posterior chain, which is the back, the glutes, the hamstrings, and I'm going to work the anterior chain, which is like the quads and even the midline, like some of the best ab exercises is just being able to do squats, right? Like that's also really good for abs. If we're talking about a parkour analogy, if I do a climb up, which is coming from, you know, a cat hang position, and then I pull into support or half cat where the object is at my waist, and then I push up out of the dip into half cat, then I'm getting both a pull and a push in one motion. So if I train just that, I would get the gains of increasing like pushing strength, but not have to separate that movement.
Work specifically on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is the first time I heard this concept was actually from my teacher in Chicago, Master Pacina, who was my wushu coach. But then more recently, it's been popularized by Philip Chubb, who's mindful mover on Instagram. And he's just been trying to say, here are the things that you can work on that will give you a lot of the things you're working on separately. But if you just do it in this one movement, you're going to get the gains. Mm-hmm. I think bro science used to call these compound movements, but I don't think the intention was the same. Meaning like, oh, if you stick to compound movements like pull-ups, push-ups, and back squat, you don't need to do all like the cable stuff and things like that. But yeah, so what we're seeking today is what techniques have we ever used for free gains, and where does this concept exist in parkour?
Yeah, so when I was asked the question, I was wondering if there, in terms of parkour skills, is there any skill that you can learn that would automatically give you experience in another, where, you know, at the very least you could just learn it very quickly in a day or so. But the more I thought about it, the more I felt like skills in parkour are like branches in a tree. And if you learn the more complicated skill, the further away you got from learning something else. So
more, as opposed to like more specialized, yeah, that you got,
learning a Kong will never teach you a Lache, right?
No. So there are some, I think there's some bigger ones, because in the tracks program, which is the adult program, I encountered this where it was like, they were only coming once a week and I had to teach them something that was safe, that they could scale. So there had to be a progression for it. So I had to have a couple things. It had to be something that was worth people's time. Mm-hmm. Meaning I don't want to bring them in and have them work on one little specialized exercise because they only come in once a week and then never, and they never grow. They grow, or they grow very slow. So it has to be worth their time. There has to be a progression, meaning I always have to find a way to make it lighter, but still be pointing at the same thing, right? We're still working towards a climb up, even though literally all I have you do right now is, you know, a cat pull and then you stand up into the press, right? Yeah. But you find yourself in support, right? But then that progresses into more difficult things. And then it has to have the broadest range of application possible. That doesn't mean we've always discovered that, but it has to have the broadest range of application that could potentially give you these free gains. Meaning, if I work on a precision to the point where I can do Lache precisions, I may be able to just do Lache precisions and be working on both precisions and Lache precisions, right? I don't need to do my precisions separate if I'm training Lache precisions in certain context.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be the only thing you want to focus on, but that would be how I'd make that decision instead of being like, well, I'm just going to program Lache's and continue to program Lache's precisions and blah, blah, blah. We try and compound those things. So what were some of the ones you thought of? I have thought about this a little bit, and so I have some suggested ones, but what were some of the ones that you thought of right away?
So the ones that came to mind initially weren't the skills, but how you perform the skills, the power up to it. Like hurdle step was one that I found that you could use, whether you're doing a lot of acrobatic stuff or you're doing more traditional parkour stuff, that step translated to aerials and side flips and front flips and Kongs and wall runs to a degree.
Absolutely.
So hurdle step was my first one that I really felt confident saying that if you learn this technique, it's going to improve a wide variety of other techniques that you have. But that's in terms of like actual skills, I couldn't find a single skill where I was like, yeah, I know if I just train this one here, I'm going to automatically learn something else. So like, I was thinking about, you know, wall runs, and I was like, well, I guess if you learn a wall flip and you just don't reach the top of the wall and you fall backwards, you get backflip. Wall flip.
Yeah.
So, but no, I was really trying to find like a special technique. Like if I just learned Kongs, was there something else that was automatically granted to me? And I couldn't actually find
one
skill.
One joke that kind of goes with that, Amos, when we did the EDU cert, would always talk about like Wu Kemi, which is a double internal play on like puns. But Wu Kemi is the discipline of learning to fall that Amos promotes. And then Wu was like, woo, that's amazing. Right. And so it's like Wu Kemi. So whenever I used to teach, because you just said the wall run thing. Mm-hmm. Whenever I used to teach wall runs to adults, I stopped doing this because I think I ran out of energy. But I would always be like, okay, so you guys do the wall run. And then I'd be explaining the technique and I could see them, their eyes kind of glaze over. They're really just like, I just want to run on the wall, dude.
Yep.
And then so at the end of it, I'd always be like, and if you do your wall run wrong, it looks like this. And then I would just do the wall flip.
Yeah.
As a joke. But, you know, so you're exactly right. And and that did help teach me something about that. Have you observed any, Jess? I'll throw a couple out that can be the spicy one.
Yeah, but most of it's gonna come from, so I think it's worth splitting them between, like, there are skill gains that you get and then there are performance gains that you get, right?
Yep.
Technical versus physiological changes.
Okay.
And I think,
yeah, explain the difference.
Well, so for example, if you want your broad jump to improve, doing heavy weighted singles or doubles on back squats will give you an increased broad jump without you ever having to work on the broad jump, right? For me though, it's tough because is that a free gain or is that just a gain, right? I think it depends really on your intention. If my intention is to do back squats to improve my broad jump, then it's not really a free gain. That was my goal at the end. But if my intention was I wanted to improve my back squat so that, you know, my booties look a little fresher come the holidays, right? And my broad jump gets improved just as a side, then the broad jump is a free gain, you know? Another example would be like working on like weighted pull-ups to improve your climb-ups, things like that. Again, the is that for a traditional athlete outside of the parkour realm, that is absolutely a free gain for them, right? They just want to get their weighted pull-up up because they're chasing the aesthetic of that, or they're chasing the actual number itself. And then as a result, if they had a parkour coach and a parkour coach was like, cool, let's try this climb up. And they're like, boom, and they rocket themselves to the top of the box. And you're like, wow, that was really impressive. And they're like, oh yeah, it's because I have a body weight and a quarter weighted pull-up, which is insane, by the way. You know, or something like that, right? Something just absolutely crazy. They're going to be good at that. So that's a free game for them. For parkour athletes, it's tough because I think parkour is the sport that gets you free gains everywhere else. So it's almost like you don't get any free gains because you are what gives everybody else the free gains, right? Like, we know that people who train parkour perform exceptionally well in just about every other athletic realm, right? Mm-hmm. The only, maybe not like being a lineman because there are physiological differences that have to be there, but a well-rounded parkour athlete could be put in just about every athletic realm out there
and be an advantage
and be good, right? Not be like amazing. Depending on the sport, they might be amazing. Depending on the sport, they might be just good, right? And there are of course a few of them that they would be just average or below average, like no better than a walk-off or a walk-on. But it's tough because parkour is typically that sport.
So I'm gonna give you two reasons why you're right. So one,
thanks.
So I'm gonna double down on what you said basically, but in my own words and experience. The one is that parkour by its very nature is learned through doing in many ways. And whenever we isolate individual movements, we're just trying to shore up strength and understanding and safety for the most part. But once you get to a certain velocity, you really don't need it as long as you focus on certain techniques. Right. And a good example of that, I think, is something like a cat leap to climb up. I think a cat leap to climb up is one thing that could be trained. And if you get cat leap to climb up, then you go to learn lachet to cat climb up. It's already done. Right. So cat leap to climb up is one of the fundamentals that I like to focus on with folks. If you can do another good example of this is if you can hang in like the 90 degree grip for the cat hang and do the pull, it may be better for you to do variations of that than actually going and doing hanging separate and then doing a pull up. It's just like, just do a cat hang with a pull. And once you can reach to the point where you're strong enough to not only grip, but also pull, then that will give you some free gains, right? Because you don't need to train the grip strength separate from the pulling strength separate from the squat position and cat hang.
Yep.
Because all of them are in there. So cat hang pull-ups, I think, are a really good example of this. Now, the early thinkers, and I think this was Method Natural, the concepts with those guys way back in the days, precursors to parkour, what do we call them? Like it'd be equivalent to like Avatar, like the first Avatar, right? You know, like the guy who like did the first fire bending.
Wan
or whatever, right, in the back of the day. Like just the ancient history guys, right?
It was just one.
So he was the first firebender who snuck off the turtle and stole the gift of fire to use in the forest, right? So we're just in my ancient history here at this point, literally. I think this is like 1800s or something. In Method Natural, they always believed if you just put people, humans, in an environment, you would teach them nothing the environment would teach them. Like you wouldn't do isolated exercises. You would just throw the human in the environment. They will adapt and they will learn in that way, right?
Or they'll die, but yeah.
Right. We now know that this is really just selection bias in some ways, right? Survivor bias, right. Yeah, this is just survivor bias in that way. But there is a lot to be said for putting yourself in the context and doing things. And the reason I think that parkour is so special is the environment. The environment is so diverse. Yep. And you're used to working with just a very complex environment. And that makes you like acutely aware of space.
Yeah.
And that pays out everywhere. So when Jesse's like, well, parkour is the discipline of adaptation in that way, you're right, because the amount, the sheer volume of like different shapes and surfaces and everything you get exposed to when you dive deeper into it just pays out everybody else. Yeah. You're not going to have trouble on a flat court if
you're used to directions.
Right, changing directions if you're used to. Now, that skill becomes very refined later on in sport, but I'm just saying, like, if you're used to running over a bunch of nut stuff and people are like, hurdles, you're like, you mean just one? And I can see it, it's painted, it's clear. Okay.
Yeah, this is really good at that. If height's the same
for all of them. Height's the same. Ground's
the
same.
If we broaden your area of free gains, parkour gets very clear to me. Because we did a couple of different sports. We did track, we did soccer, and I did football. And for my examples, in track, I'd never trained sprinting in my life. But parkour, you absolutely have to be good at sprinting off the start, right? In the mm-hmm. short and in a limited number of steps. So Jesse and I were both very good sprinters. That was pretty natural for us. In football, I think the free gain in football was far more comfort in being in the air. I remember a couple times scoring a touchdown by jumping over someone. I remember getting an interception by jumping over someone. And it's not something that I planned or trained for in football. They actually train you not to jump, right? They right. don't want you to be in
especially
the air.
Especially as a little guy.
Especially as a 5'6" guy. You don't want to be in the air. But it paid off for a couple times. It also was the death of me in some ways when I jumped. but I remember doing naturally jumping over people and intercepting footballs. And that was stuff that I couldn't have trained during football, but I had a natural free gain, a free touchdown from training in parkour. And just being so used to jumping over something without looking at it and planning my steps. So that one was a pretty visible, attainable, tangible free gain for me. So yeah, if you're looking outside, mm-hmm. I also remember being tripped a lot of times when I was a kid and the roll coming right out of it. Or yeah. falling downstairs, right? Like slipping on ice is something I never worry about. So there are those like little elements that I think that I feel like are true free gains, but there's not like I'm something I'm super stoked about. It's like when I trip on ice and I'm carrying groceries and I catch myself and I'm not really afraid of it. That is a free gain. I never trained
trip,
that
when
particular.
You trip in the gym on the way to the lobby yeah. with your laptop and you're like, oh.
Yeah, those aren't like gains where I'm like, I need to learn clip. How to trip on ice. Like, I'm not training that. So, yeah, that clip on
it's a thing. Camera. That clip is a thing. That trip, that fall is real. Yeah. It's not when I was making stuff up.
It's true. That. I think one of the biggest, free gains that parkour does give is just a comfort in environments as it relates to, like, the unpredictability of it, mm-hmm. right? The other day, I'm just gonna come out here. I'll just own it. I was doing the tour, right?
Oh yeah, moment of honesty. Moment of honesty.
In the middle of a tour, so I just have a general policy that when I'm doing tours, I don't demo. One, because I'm not warmed up, and two, that I feel like it sends kind of the wrong precedents about what we're here. We're here to teach, and not here to like do stunts, right? We're not like here to show off, and so. So
but it's
normally,
COVID. We gotta sell.
Yeah, apparently. and I think I was just in a mood where I was like, yeah, sure, I'll do a swing. And I wasn't intending it to be a big swing, right? But it reinforces why I don't demo during a tour. Anyway, so I go up for the bar. I'm just gonna do this like lache that I've hit, 100 times, just as like a warm up. And I go and I cast. And as soon as I cast, I feel my palms and I'm like, okay. It's we're gonna have to find a way to like tuck this in. So I cast and I peel out and we can't link the clip actually for liability reasons. But anyways,
edit that shit in.
So I peel out and there's like a slanted wall that I like am heading towards at a very fast speed and butt first like upside down. But as soon as I cast and I knew that peel out was gonna happen, there was no panic. It was like I'm gonna peel out on this. And so you can see in the clip I just kind of like whoop, and then I stand up and I joke and I laugh and then I go back and I hit the lache again afterwards. But I distinctly remember being in the air and just being like, oh,
yeah,
dang. Like not being like scared. Just being annoyed
and disappointed.
And I was like, oh my God.
You
I
felt like air thing. Shame?
And I was just like in the air, just limp as I like slam into the wall. And I'm like, boom, boom, boom. I'm like, all
right. Yes.
It was more annoying than anything else, right? But that comfort level absolutely comes from like, and that happens pretty much anytime I fall. Yeah. Like when I trip on the stairs at home, which happens all the time because I have cats, I'm just like, oh, and I'm falling down the stairs and my face looks like this. Like I'm just like, oh, dang it. It's annoying, right?
So I think that the other thing that people have to understand is that this is not just like a hyperbole. The I've seen Jesse fall a bunch of times. Actually, from that, you should probably just get off that bar, because the other one was when you were doing that giant and then you got upside down and your hand slipped and then just started going straight down from the giant. And I just like, I always, again, I'll reiterate this. My spidey senses about what my students get to learn and how good I think someone is comes from how much fear I feel when I watch them. And I, for Jesse, I almost am never afraid, except for that time you were driving down, that guy got in your lane and was driving like straight towards you in a car in a in a one way. Yeah, he was going the wrong way in a one way. I was worried for you then. I was not confident you would be able to evade that right before you lost that hamster.
Is this in Loveland?
No, this was on Mulberry.
Oh, really?
So we were driving down the street, just side note, so because I know
the hamster is also the Kia Soul.
Yes, sorry.
Marketing by hamster.
Was I in the wrong lane?
No, you were in the right lane.
I was like, I was like, I mean, I know I'm not a great driver, which is why I haven't driven for 8 years, but I was like, I'm not that bad.
No, it was just a one-way.
It was a one-way, and construction had changed it so that the road people were used to driving down was the wrong way, and there was only one lane, but someone else had turned into your lane, and you were going correctly. But the construction diverted someone into you, and they were, and no one was stopping. Like you guys were just headlights. Just it was at night, and we thought you were gonna just like run right into each other. But there was an evasion that occurred, I guess. So maybe you did get that one to work too. Anyway, but I also like to say that like people should know. This is an opinion that I have of Jesse that I haven't verbalized. I think Jesse is probably like the best athlete that I have a relationship with. Like I've met athletes that are there, but I actually think not only that, this is your birthday. This is not your birthday gift. Maybe it is. I don't know. Too much compliments.
Compliments.
I also think that Jesse is definitely the most underrated athlete in the state of Colorado. I think that, I would hands down say that. I don't think people know. I don't think you flex real hard, so they don't know, but you guys got to know. And he's like, I let go of LSA. We'll show the video. We'll find it. Yeah. Blur your face out or something.
Oh, no, I meant for the people in the tour, but yeah.
Oh, yeah. Blur their face out or something. People but see you my won't, face. You'll see it and you'll be like, oh, it won't feel like he was going to die. You'll watch it and you'll be like, oh.
That's kind of the worst part about it, too, is that it just, if I were to see a student do what Jesse did, it would be like, that bar's going off. We're never getting another bar sim. Mm-hmm. Because this kid almost just killed himself and scared everybody else, but it's Jesse, right? So, you know, there's control in the air. There's posture that you can see when you watch Jesse's battle.
Yeah, for sure. And so that comes from, I think that Jesse also enjoys a amount of athleticism that's natural and genetic, but through his behaviors. Like he's like, he works really hard at really high level stuff, and that makes him better. So he is a perfect example of like all other things, like being out of the way, you know, he works on the things that gives him the best results, and he just doesn't deal with the other stuff, but maybe runs some experiments. That's why we always joke that he's a bit like bit of an edgelord archetype, a little bit of a mad scientist. Not
alchemist.
The alchemist, a bit of an alchemist. Runs his little experiments, and you're over there, I'm like, he's either going to get twice as good or lose a limb from that. I'm not really sure. So that's the sort of approach that he takes. But for us mortals, I think that there are a few things that I'll point out. And this is the goal that most of my programming for new adults comes from doing things that in training will stop them from hurting themselves, but also make them better. So they're like, it's like the potential risk that I've relived and seen in each of them, I know, and I'm preventing that. So here's a perfect example of that. And if you're a parkour coach, I'm adamant you should teach this way. What is the first vault everyone learns?
His steppy.
The steppy vault. Some people call it a safety vault, even though I would argue it's not that safe because I've had a lot of injuries.
Some people call it the climbing uppy downy.
The uppy uppy downy vault, right? No, that's a sense and descent. I don't know. So here's the tip.
I'm seeing the moment.
Justin's got it. It's that, you know, I think people assume that we talk about programming with each other way more than we actually do. But that's okay because we're kind of running our own experiments, and where there's overlap, we know there's probably truth. So the step ball, I teach it as gather pop step. Because if I teach someone the pop vault with a gather leading into it, I can teach them the scoop and the approach, so they're lighter.
That's the hurdle step that Justin was mentioning earlier.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And
also called gather.
Also called gather, yeah. Sorry, that hurdle step. So they start from 2 feet. They learn spacing as to what their range is when they approach a target. They learn the same setup, which will go for the wall run, which will go for the Kong vault, which will go for the aerial, which will go for the Webster, which will go for everything, is learning that gather hurdle step.
Yep.
Then people say, then why you teach the pop? Traditionally, we would teach someone a step vault and later on teach them a pop vault, which is just where you step on the wall before you enter the step itself on top of the box. And that training methodology is pretty much what I see standard. But the reason I flipped it is because it becomes a break. And then I don't ever have to teach it again. You can always go up. So if I take if I have a hot-headed student that comes in, the pop will always break them. So if they run at the box, they don't trip in the step because they have to pop. And then they also have to learn the approach. So I will teach them in the beginning those approaches, and then they step on the box. And then when they thread through, I teach them sit and then dash out. So now in that whole line, they've essentially learned what the range, the setup, the approach, the pop through the gather, the pop step. So if something gets higher, they can always pop into like a crane, right, for a wall run or something like that. If they thread through into a seated position, they know a dash exit for descents, and they're used to split leg exits from their step ball. So when then later on, I'm just like, okay, well, the next progression is you're not going to step on the wall. You're going to adjust your foot down so you land, and that landing foot or that last stepping foot on the ground is what's going to give you the feeling of where you when you're taking off and approaching. So then you do your step. You just go backwards and you get your step.
It actually makes a ton of sense, because one of the ways that we scale down movements are by increasing points of contact through the movement, right? That's why we use step vault before speed vault, because a speed vault is a single point of contact and step vault is two points of contact. So you're essentially taking that same methodology and just going a step earlier,
going backwards, where
now you're adding a third, you know, point of contact for the entire movement. Yeah, I think that's a fantastic. And it's something that a lot of kids who can't vault the standard height vault boxes that we had to build the mini ones for, they would do naturally anyways, because they have to like run and jump up to it. And then they almost always have like a crane position with that bottom foot, right? So it ends up helping them too, because then they can work on taller vault boxes without having to need, you know, to just like have this awesome running jump.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So. And yeah, if you can get that step down, I mean, I feel like so many other skills are difficult because you have to worry about your steps leading into it, especially in acrobatic sides and free running side. But in Terra too, oftentimes if you don't have a gym and you're stuck with, you know, doing a stride between two things where you can't change the distance, not having to learn the steps there and then and do the jump afterwards. So definitely a free game.
It's absolutely free.
Yep.
You are just sort of like, I think where this may sort of be a, there may be some conflict with the concept, is that really in that situation, the real free gain is the gather pops step. But the rest of the stuff is sort of just combining a bunch of things together into one line. It's like, if I was going to say like, all right, if I really just wanted to teach everybody parkour, and I only had one line, it would be something like a gather, pop, step, Kong, Lache, Pre, plyo, climb up, right? And then you're like, okay, well, there's your free gains. Well, that's an entire like gym length of work, right? Yeah, yeah. But that's the type of thing that I would do if I was like, had to set somebody on autopilot to learn and then just scale those things out, right? And then cat back, do the same thing backwards or something. I don't know. So that's what I try to do. Another thing is when I teach that way, I can give someone those instructions and I can leave them for a solid 2-3 minutes alone to work on that and then go help someone else, because there's just so much to chew on in that, in that chunk. If I'm just like step vault, I'd be back in 30 seconds because they'll be tired and bored. But I'm like, okay, did you get your gathered on? They're like, oh, I can't get my spacing right on my feet. Good. Eventually that will become an intuition. That's a free game. Mm-hmm. Like parkour athletes look at something 10 feet away and can tell you, oh, that's four steps.
Oh yeah.
Oh, that's three. That's two.
Well, oh, yes. One there. We have very good measuring sticks.
Yeah, we have built in ones.
Yeah. And with your feet, but also just with your depth perception. It's pretty easy for you to look up and be like, oh, that's 12 feet.
In fact, I've done that several times on like touring houses where I'd be like, oh, how tall is that? And they'd be like, oh, I think that's 10. And they'd be like, no, that's 12 foot ceiling. And then, you know, of course, Carly always teases me and she's like, you don't know that. And like, you grab 10 minutes, that's 12 foot, I guarantee it, right? It was the peak in our the condo is 13 feet. And I called it when we did the tour. I was like, I think that's 13. And then the realtor was like, oh, well, we could check. Pulls out his tape measure. And he's like, yeah, it's 13. Mm-hmm. And I was like, yeah, because I can't wall run that.
We also
that's
have
how I
like,
know that parkour people are good estimators
and yeah. also become like what geometric narcissists at that point, right? Because we always think we know the distance.
Oh, yeah.
You're always like, oh no, that's I'm that way too. I'm adamant. I'm a little, yeah. I've been wrong. I'm so soured by it.
Like, and it's usually like within the realm of what you can do, right? You look at a gap and you're like, oh, that's 10 feet. So like, how do you know that's 10 feet? And you're like, because I can hit it and I know that it'll be just right on the edge of like my max distance,
right?
Know, for a pre is right there, so I know that that's 10 feet because I can feel it. That's absolutely, yeah, you're a better distance estimator.
Yeah,
you'd be great. What is that? Easy and like, you know, whatever that
estimator,
right? It's called surveyor.
Yeah. For shorter distances.
Parker
you wouldn't
surveyor.
Be able to like that's 430 meters.
Yeah. That CrossFit will teach you that.
That's
oh, run over there. Yeah, that's 400. I do like the CrossFit helped teach me like the metric system. That like that was really cool. Mm-hmm. I've got another one. Okay, and that is Cat Leap Climb Up. I think that Cat Leap Climb Up is your upper body equivalent. And the progressions that I teach for that aren't as obvious. Like, you can't just step into that. But I will actually start from, like, standing with one leg up on cat in a cat hang with an overhand grip. This is a training tidbit for climb-ups that I think a lot of people could use is undertrained in the parkour world. And that is overhand grip climb-ups, especially for adults and kids. Because sometimes the grip strength is the limiting factor.
Yep.
And you want to be able to get a ton of volume in with your climb up. So I will literally start, and I'll post this on TikTok for the gym or for on my channel or whatever too, because I was showing them last night to the new people. Mm-hmm. And Jesse was sitting there watching. And in this progression, both of you guys were there.
Oh, I was. Yeah.
Over there. Mm-hmm. And in this progression, I use a wall where the fingers go over the top, and then I let them progress from basically standing with one foot on a box and the other foot above it at the cat hang height with an overhand grip. And I let them stand up into their climb up, but I ask them to keep their chest as close to the wall coming over the top as possible. And they do reps like that. Now, the free gain there is that not only are they working on the upper body strength of the pull, but they're also priming the mechanic and the timing for the climb up. So that when it comes time for me to like be like, okay, you guys, now we're going to do the wall run and you're going to top out. They're like, oh, wait, I already know the top part of this. Yeah, that's because the way you've been training your climb ups has been from the ground, standing on the ground. Pulling over, it requires some adjustment for where your base foot is on that. And then when I teach them, ask them to start to add the cat leap in, then they've already got what the foot positioning is. They also know where their bail is because they can put their foot down to save themselves. Mm-hmm. And then I'm just like, are you strong enough to grip onto a 90 degree grip? Okay, cool. Now you've already got it. You don't have to train anything new. All your foundation built up to that. And we do the cat leap itself, you're already used to going from a step with the leg down into the cat hang and coming up. So again, you've already done it. So I think it's more of in parkour, it's more of, have you already done it? And while we could separate some of the movements and be like, I'm going to teach you all your like cat leaps separate from your cat back, separate from your climb up, separate from your wall top out. If we teach those, if you try and broaden those and teach those all in one progression, then you just get the free gains when you go to the next one because you've already been exposed to the more optimal mechanic. But I think this is counter to how a lot of people like to train parkour, which is introduce someone to an obstacle and then give them the options to get on it or mm-hmm. overcome it, right? isn't that, would you say that's the dominant means of training? Can you explain that a little bit and why that is? Because as a person who was, who came in from like a more of a martial arts structured fitness approach, you know, when I originally 8 years got in parkour, that was very interesting to me.
It's the exact opposite of gymnastics as well. It's like you do exercises that don't look like they resemble any type of skill that you perform, but eventually the pieces add together. So I feel like that is, parkour is super objective. So it's very easy to see the point A and point B and to just tackle the challenge as it is and to not require other equipment or other, you know.
Finesse even.
Finesse for sure. Yes, because you get on top of the wall, you did it. So I think it's just because it's very easy to just view parkour as objective wins. If you made it across the gap, you did it. How you made it, how it looked aren't quite as important as just doing it.
That's where
it.
The fun comes in parkour,
right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I think it's
task completion.
Yeah. It is so task completion. It's easier to just coach like that. And it's pretty easy to get that sense of accomplishment when the day that you were trying to learn to climb up, you were on top of the wall, as opposed to the gymnastics format where you spend 2 years trying to learn a front flip and you finally get the front flip after 2 years of learning, you know, hollow and handsprings and a dozen other skills.
Unnecessary. This is unnecessary, right? Because we have kids with no background in that. They come in here and learn triples.
Yeah.
A triple rotation with no traditional. Now, they need to stretch a little bit more. We could probably throw out some free gains on stretching that would balance that out. But that would tell you that, you know what, you really don't need to spend 4 years building up to this technique. No. If your real goal was achieving it and not just following your dogmatic ritualistic process, you could do better for these kids.
Yeah, I think if I were to give a free gain to gymnastics, I would say discipline and the their ability to focus on like minute details of their mechanics.
So what is the free gain for discipline? Because I think there's some truth to that, but I don't think that means you need to do 2 years to do something. I think that
because is
discipline just boot camp? Has military figured this out? Yeah. You know, you
yeah,
just
it's not it's not gymnastics not unique in their discipline, right? So. What was your question again?
Yeah, just like what the free gain for discipline would be, because that approach isn't necessary. But even if we look at like a very freelance character like Dennis Rodman, all right, who played for the Bulls and was known for just like going and winning, they'd win games, but he'd just dip out. Like they would be training for like finals and then he would disappear and go to Vegas or show up on like WWE or something like that. And they'd be like, where is Dennis? And they'd be like, he's just gone. He's in with Kim in North Korea or something. I don't know. But so somehow you still can't get away with that. We may be doing too much unnecessary work. And I think that is some of the concept that comes from the free gains circle right now, too, is that what am I doing for not? Like, what am I doing more than I really need to? Or am I lying to myself that I really need to be doing 3 times a week training this when maybe I could get away with 1?
Yep.
Have I tested it? Have you ever experienced something where you had been doing a lot of work towards something and then when you were just honest with yourself later on were like, you know what, I really feel best when I'm doing this, but otherwise I had just been following programming, right? Like a preconceived notion about how you approach something. Can you guys think of a skill or something, just some gain in general that you just scrapped sort of the unnecessary, you know, ideas around it and still got your gains?
Not in philosophy, but certainly when I pay somebody else to do my programming, I look at their programming and I take about a quarter of it
and just cut it out.
You know, I don't tell them about it. I'm like, oh, by the way, we changed this. Most of the time, cause I'm just like, ain't got time for that. That just sounds boring. That looks like fun, right? And then, of course, like, I'll try it just to make sure because I don't know what I don't know, which is why I've hired this person anyways, right? And so I'll go through their stuff for a couple of times just to see if there's any sort of gold that I'm missing. But for the most part, I'm like, I know that I don't need to do like Scott, you know, dumbbell curls for if I'm trying to like improve my pulling strength, right? It's probably not really the method I'm looking for here. So I'll scrap that or replace it with something else. But yeah, I mean, that entire concept is like, I'm looking at what is the primary goal of this session or this cycle, and can I get the same goal done without as much volume and time spent in there, right? If they're prescribing 10 rounds of 1 minute of jump rope, and I'm like, this is a broad jump program, so I probably don't need 10 minutes of jump rope, right? Mm-hmm. In every session. So I'll scrap that and I'll do 1 minute of jump rope instead or something like that, right?
Do you feel, have you ran across anything like that before?
No, I don't. Not something that comes right to my head. The ones that do, I feel like someone else came along and was like, well, instead of, you know, in terms of the front flip, we had Jenks come and teach a front flip workshop, and front flips were always a hard element for skill for me to learn. And I think it's because it's so easy to focus on the most obvious anterior part of a front flip,
mm-hmm.
and then someone like James comes along and he's like, nope, it's posterior, right? And all of a sudden it's like, oh, I've been concentrating on this side of the movement, but really if I had, you know, watched people do front flips who have them efficient, not the gymnastic style of course, who are mostly free runners, you'll see that the most of that effort is in the posterior hip raise, right? And once I figured that out, it was like, oh, now I don't really need to focus on any other part of the front flip except the posterior part, right? That hip raise and front flips just happen. So along those lines, I feel like I have a few more or more examples. I can't think of them right now, but where it's like it's the movement is so obvious, like a Kong. It's so obvious to put your hands on it and to imagine your feet going through. But really in a Kong, it's more about getting your hips over and just leaning and forwards on the box, right?
Yeah, coming to that forward motion. Like why, if you're trying to go forward, would you stop yourself from going forward?
Yeah,
right. It should be assisting. One of the ones that I want to point out too, a strength one and then a parkour like technique one. One is the arm swing reset on jumps. This is a very big free gain, and I would argue maybe this is my biggest free gain that I don't see out there. As a matter of fact, I think I recently saw someone do a really crappy variation of this technique, and then a bunch of people in the parkour community were kind of like, that's dumb, I don't even understand why they're doing that. But right away I got what they were trying to do, but the application was not clear, so it didn't make sense. And so what I'm talking about is when I teach my adults to do their jumps, this is or kids, whomever I'm teaching, right? Because I do this now with the overdrive kids too. When they do a jump, even though it's not necessary, I will have them reset their arms behind them in the jump. So if I'm standing and I do a standing tuck jump, like we're playing the game where you're trying to do soft landings, I'll teach them to jump up, set the arms up, and then before they land, pull the arms back through, loading behind them like it's in their pockets. I call it a falcon because an eagle is like you're trying to get really far back, but falcons maybe a little less. I don't know. I was looking for another word for it. Maybe it'll stick. Maybe it won't. And then they land and they scoop in that precision landing position that you would really only notice someone doing if they were doing like an 80% plus effort, like running pre or lache pre, where the arms come way behind as they land in and they scoop up. Well, I start teaching that to students right away. That's the first thing they learn in their jump. So then every jump thereafter, even though they're jumping on flat, if they train that way, when they go to jump to precision, their precisions are like 100 times more efficient, because they're always able to balance, to counterbalance. So what I'll teach them is a standing tuck jump where the arms set over the head, they pull back behind, and when they land in precision position. So they're not allowed to rock backwards on their heels or fall forward and take a step. Then even though they're on flat, they're technically training precisions right out the gate. Like your first lesson is jump up, cool, pull your arms behind you before you land. Oh, can't get it. It's way harder for them than you think. And then you think, oh man, imagine if they had to learn that skill in an 8-foot broad jump, but it just didn't arrive until the future where they had to own up to that deficit.
Yeah.
So that's a free gain that I teach. So I teach precision jumps with the arms behind from the ground up. Then they always have that one. Where I've asked, that's a combination one. And I think most people look at that and they say, well, that's unnecessary for you to teach that at that stage. I would argue it's not, because there are almost no cases where you don't use that anyway. There are examples where you change, moving from monkey plant to something where your hands actually stay in front of you. There are some examples of that, but the vast majority of time that you're sticking a precision, there's some, even if it's a subtle like pull and scoop in it. Even if I just hop on something, it's just a little bit of this, a little bit of that chest lift, or if I come off of a wall, bouncing back to the ground in order to take energy out of that drop. I'm going to treat it a little bit like a plyo when I hit the ground, absorb, and then stamp. Yeah. I'm not just like push into the ground. So it's everywhere. That arm reset is a free game, 100%. The other one that I've used that has a, that's a strength example is that I was doing, I've done like GG Mufu's programming, I've done like Flexibles programming, ATG, some FRC stuff, all on middle split, just because I work, I like to work on my middle split. It's been a sore point for me for a long time now, but it's something that isn't really parkour specific, but I want to work on. It's also could be cool for like kicks and tricks and stuff. It's kind of more aesthetic. But I remember I recently came to this conclusion, which was, if I do strength training before I do my stretch training, I will almost always be more open. Meaning if I take a 45-minute session or an hour and a half session on stretching and I go through mechanistically and I do my pancake and then I do the middle split and I do my horse stance and then I isolate my hips and tilt forward and I'm just sort of like working through everything because I'm working on stretching, flexibility, right? That's what you think you're supposed to do. I've recently found that if I just do a decent set of back squats beforehand, I don't need any of that. I can go right to the depth work and start loading it in a deeper amount, right? Because think about it. We don't correlate the two, but you know if you do a few back squats, like a set of back squats, a couple sets of back squats, you're gonna feel super open in the hips. And the way I discovered this was I had some programming where I was working on middle split training, but one day had pistol squats in it, and the other day had, because I was combining both to save time, but one day had pistol squats in it, and the other day had back squat in it. And then it was like every other session, I'd be like, man, I go into my splits and they're just awesome. And then I'd be like, the next time I'd be like, oh, they aren't. I must be too tired. And then it took me two times through before I realized that it was back squats that determined whether my session was awesome or not. And so then I pulled out, I do back squats in every middle split session. Yep. And I can get to the depth so much faster. So that's a good example of like a free game, back squat. But this is a back squat that Jesse should talk about because you're really good, like deep double weight body back squat, right? Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about the range of back squat and why that matters, because most people are doing sort of like pseudo back squats or just not through the full range.
I think it changes, right? Because some people are doing low bar back squat, mm-hmm. and some people are doing high bar back squat. And I think for most parkour athletes, high bar back squat should be the goal. Front squat even more, but front squat's just it's almost unnecessarily comfortable if you don't have the anatomic build for it. Mm-hmm. So like you don't need to choke yourself if it's just not your thing. You'll get pretty similar effects in a high bar. But yeah, I mean the back squat itself and a high bar back squat is the absolute lowest you can go, right? It is if you take a pancake position, right, which is legs in a V, you're sitting on the ground, leaning forward, trying to push your belly button to the floor. If you take that position and you just take the femurs and the hips and you tilt that 90 degrees, that's your back squat, right? That's a high bar back squat. That's why it matters so much that you're getting full depth on a back squat, whereas a low bar is going to be a little bit more forward. It's going to be more of a 45 degree tilt, right? And you're not going to get the same depth of that weight pushing your hips straight down. So ideally in a high bar back squat, that weight's stacked on top of your shoulders. It runs all the way down to the very like tip of your tailbone, right? Your coccyx, and it's pushing you vertically into the ground. Whereas in a low bar back squat, you're going to be tipped a little bit. So that it's not going to be an exact push down. So you're not going to get the same effect. But obviously you can see why if you're in that position, if somebody were to be behind you in a pancake and gently but strongly push your lumbar down, that's essentially what the back squat's doing for
you. The weight is doing that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The weight's doing that for you. So then when you go to do your middle splits, you're obviously going to be pretty warmed up.
Pretty primed for them.
Yeah. But the great thing about the back squat versus somebody pushing you is that person doesn't get any neural feedback of how much pain you're in, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. and a high bar back squat, you have to be, one, somebody pushing on you doesn't get any neural feedback of like, oh, is Travis in pain or not? They also don't get any feedback of whether you're engaged or not, right? So typically in a pancake, it's a passive stretch. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to do that actively. Because your legs aren't braced against anything, right? It's an open kinetic movement rather than a closed chain. And so in the back squat, though, you have to be engaged or the weight will destroy you. Mm-hmm. So you're engaged from the top all the way down, and you're getting feedback the entire time around like which muscles are flexing to open and increase that range of motion. So
the additional benefit of the back squat when done that way is a very simple exercise, you guys. If you're in a back squat, most people know what back squats are. And you go into that movement. So the bar is loaded on the back of your shoulders. There's a bar, there's weight on the bar, and then you're squatting under that load. So that's the back squat we're talking about. In the low bar back squat, that position is further down the back, and there's a little bit of a lean, and you're sort of engaging the posterior chain earlier when you don't need to go as low. And that's why power lifters like it, because they only have to reach a certain depth, which is usually measured by the crease of the hip below the knee, in order to ensure that the femur is below parallel, mm-hmm. and that counts as their rep. But this is a arbitrary objective. It's just going low enough for it to count, right? Yeah. Whereas maybe in like Olympic lifting or in parkour, where we do care about being loaded at our max end range of motion, it's a range of strength question, which is more valuable for us. So that's why I think we prefer the high bar back squat. And if you have been loading weight and not going as far down as you can, you should take weight off, because just because you can move maybe even, you know, the double body weight through a particular range, as soon as you start going outside of that range, you are introducing risk, and you're also introducing a range of strength you haven't been training in. This is why when we see people do like Ninja Warrior and their arms are all bent like this through the entire thing, like a T-Rex doing the course. It's like, because, right, they don't have the range of full extension and strength that people in parkour do, because they go into the full cat hang at times, even though that can be faster with having bent. But most parkour people still can go full range in their cat hangs and in their liches. And you don't see that when people are untrained. So the range of strength in the back squat matters, because and this is why I think a back squat is a free gains lift for parkour, is that for life, really, is that you can then catch yourself very deep in a squat in a precision position. But you can only do so if you're training your back squat as low as you train your precision depth for catching. So if you're a parkour athlete and you're listening, you know, we saw this early on with like Dylan Baker when we did the jump training down with Ryan a few years ago. And this guy didn't even lift weights and had a double body weight back squat, basically. Well, he was doing 225, but an untrained person doing 225 is pretty solid in their back squat. Full range, just hitting it as low as he would hit any precision, doesn't do any weight lifting, just gets underneath it, goes full range, comes back up. Bit of an athletic freak too, but I'm just saying that's there from parkour already, because you've been loading into a deep range. When we do parkour, we wouldn't like stop at a depth on a precision, because we're going to try and get that move. So we're going to let ourselves go into that deep position.
Yeah.
Don't learn that at the same time you're taking impact. If you can do the back squat or even an air squat like that and try and keep that good posture and learn that full range of strength, I'm telling you. And a lot of times people are like worried about their posterior chain too. This is another example. A lot of people won't train the back squat because they're worried that it's not working the posterior chain, and then they'll unnecessarily work on deadlift, which isn't bad, but they could also be getting posterior. What?
No, it's long so story. Silly to me.
I'm
going to work on my posterior chain.
Right.
Yeah.
So, well, okay, what I mean by that is, wait, what?
No, you keep going.
No, okay. I'm not making fun of you. I'm making fun of people who are like, oh, it's a glute day.
It's a glute day. All right, they're parsing it out.
Just do back squats, your butt will be just fine.
If you actually go low, you can avoid your butt and do a back squat. I see people doing it all the time. If you go as deep as, like, check Jesse's Instagram. I think you have some back squats on there, right? I don't have any on mine.
I think so.
Yeah. If you check Jesse's Instagram, the back squat is very deep. You will know. It's almost more like you were saying pancake earlier, but I really think it's more like a high hamstring pancake. Because when you're in pancake and your legs are straight, you sort of get the lower parts of the hamstring behind the knee, maybe even some calf stuff. Nah, not really. But when you bend that leg, now you're loosening the meat in the hamstring and the posterior chain behind the knee, and it's all right above the glute. And if you do a deep, deep back squat, your booty and hamstrings are going to be hurting. And that's, and I'm not saying that's when you, that's when you know you did it right, but I'm just saying that's when you know you got the full range. Because if people right now are like, well, I do back squats, but usually my butt doesn't bother me, then you're not, you're not only over doing them. Yeah. Did they bother you?
Oh, yeah. That's why it was weird. We had a podcast earlier. We were talking about how much it hurts to sit on the toilet in the morning.
After back squats?
Yeah. After a nice back squat session. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And that's, yeah, that's a great feeling.
Love that feeling.
Yeah. I still don't get it. I think I had that. I was reminded by that conversation because I think I had a couple days ago where I had trained something. And I can't remember what I was training. But I got out and it hurt, but it hurt so good the next day. And I was like, oh, this must be what Jesse and Justin were talking about. I don't know if I...
Then, I can't believe you don't. Like, that's just every
no, mine story. Just hurts like I'm like it just aches. Like, don't touch me.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, we have gone over that before, haven't we?
Yeah, we're a little masochist.
I love it. Yeah, I like it. Just like 2 a.m. sitting on the toilet. I make sure that Lindsay hears me and wakes up. And she's like, what's wrong? Just sore.
Dude, yeah.
just gotta let everybody know when I'm sore.
And I'm like walking up the stairs at my house, I'm just like, the whole time it's like, like that's it. That's me going up the stairs and my five steps or whatever. Each step is a grunt. It's not because I actually need to grunt, but I'm celebrating the pain. Yeah. I'm like, yeah.
The celebration is good. A lot of people try to call it whining, but you know, it's celebration.
Yeah. I ain't whining. You ain't back squatting. Huh?
It's true.
But yeah, I think I guess if you wanted one move that would give you free gains for all of parkour, it would have to be back squat.
I think back squat. Yeah, I mean, if you want to get really high level, it's the snatch. But that takes so long to learn at the level that it would be most effective, that it's just kind of inefficient.
Dude, I have a ton of people, and this is why I think you're right with the snatch. There's some truth there because I constantly get pushback when I say that the Olympic lifts could provide some benefit to parkour athletes. And one day, somebody who's got a lot of clout, maybe it'll be me, one day I'll have like Donald Trump clout and people will just cultishly listen to me. But I have...
Come to take my clout.
Did you come to take my clout? Piccolo. But like a perfect example of this is yesterday, one of the coaches is working, I won't name names, is working on overhead squat with a plate, trying to get full range of motion, and I'm just like, oh, you mean like this? Boom, 25 pounds, ATG squat with one dumbbell overhead. And that used to be a trick that we would have bro science dudes come into like the gyms or whatever when we were training the Olympic stuff and be like, hey dude, take this 25 pound dumbbell and just do your squat and see if you can hold over your head. And they can't because it becomes like a front lever, or not a front lever, an anterior like raise with the dumbbell in front of their body if you don't have the overhead shoulder range of motion. So the precursor to being able to do the snatch is being able to do an overhead squat with full range. Like you need your full like ATG, you know, arse to grass squat to get into a snatch. Your limiting factor in the upper body for your snatch is overhead squat.
Yeah. In fact, it's funny because that's my athlete and he's doing that to build overhead strength.
Which will work.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying, I already had this for gains because I had already been working.
I think you genetically had those. I don't think you ever gained those.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, so there are people who
helped me with that.
I think it definitely helped you keep it. Because
that was a lot of shoulder.
But like, there are things that, we've talked about this a couple of times, that like, you're just genetically are going to be predisposed for. Having a longer femur means you're a better jumper, period. That's math. There's no arguing around that.
Is it really the long femur just make? Which is because you can go further.
It's a longer lever.
It's a short
trebuchet versus a long trebuchet. Which one's gonna throw the rock farther?
Maybe with jumping because you're talking about distance. But with strength, longer levers aren't a benefit. Like a bench presser.
And yet here I see who's the strongest man in the world is 6'3". Huh?
Thor?
Right? Yeah.
Thor.
So like I hear this argument that like that like taller people have a disadvantage mathematically in strength, but it's not if we're just looking at the bones, it is, but you also have a lot more muscle tissue that's because of that longer bone. So it's actually not true that it's like, ah, strength people are like short people, or you're going to be able to deadlift more. Then why is it that the world's strong, like most amount ever lifted in a deadlift is from a dude who's 6.5 feet tall?
I mean, it's, he is just bigger, I mean, though, too.
Yeah, this that's is my point. It's my point is you don't get tall without being bigger.
No, like some people are like, look, let's take, for example, by that logic, Colin should have the strongest ankles, but he has the weakest ankles in the gym.
Oh, wow, Colin.
That's dirty, dude.
This is, you got to know Colin. This, Colin, make me not sound like a jerk. Is this true? Is this not?
No, they're pretty strong.
Okay.
They snap at like this point when I'm like as pressed up against a thing, but it was only a sprain. It didn't even break.
My point is that Colin has a size. What are you, a size? How tall are you, Colin?
5'9".
And then what size shoe do you wear?
Depends on the shoe.
So 12 and a half, 13 on a good day, let's say, right?
Usually like 11.
So 13, size 13 on Tinder. I've worn 12s before. What?
On Tinder, I'm 6 foot.
And 6 foot, but what size your shoe on Tinder?
Dang, you jump?
What?
3 inches on Tinder? Yeah. Anyways, well, I'll bring this up. I'll give a, this is a physics problem. And when you're short, you were doing less work. So when you do less work, it seems easier because you're doing less work. You're moving things not as far, right? So when it comes to being taller and having longer femurs, you have to move things a greater distance. But that doesn't mean that you will never be as strong as a short person. Just means that my frame of reference is I'm just doing like 50% work as you because I'm 50% as tall as you. So when you're tall and you can do, you know, your full work capacity is always going to be greater than mine, right? Mm-hmm. Because you're bigger and because you're moving more stuff. So you are just lifting things higher than I will ever lift. I can only stand so tall, right? So you are going to be stronger just by the definition of work. Because you have more weight, your you're moving more,
to do
you're
work is higher.
Moving at more distance. So, mm-hmm. And in terms of a broad jump, if you take the weight away, you are able to go further. So you will be doing more work than I ever will.
So, I think that,
but it doesn't mean that you are just automatically, you know, better at that. It just means your capacity is better than mine. Yeah. Your potential.
Yeah, the potential because of the femur range. Mikey and I are a fun. Now we know the coach. Dang it, Mikey and I. But I would also like to call. We need to do some experiments between me and Mikey because I call him like my twin, my yin yang twin, because we are like our proportions are almost exact. I think we're within 3 pounds of each other of body weight. Our wingspan is like within an inch. Our height is the exact same. Our torso ratio is the same. And so I think we would be good examples of like, let's train people to have people try exercises differently. Mm. I would also say, I just think he's tight and hasn't done enough of that. So programming it is good because the dude can lache 5 times as far as I can, right? Oh no, that's a lie. Twice.
5 times.
I'm just saying, like, trying to give him some credit. All right. He's a monster lache.
Yeah.
He's a monster lache guy. So his upper body strength or his tendons are very strong and tight, in my opinion. And I think it's some of that lache strength that he just, you know, he could broaden and have both. And so he probably has more capacity for lache potential. But I just think it's because that's how he's trained, you know, tight. You know, when he was a kid and we were training him, you know, I can remember training him and he did not have that. Like, that was not gifted to him. He's acquired that skill over time. But, yeah, that'd be cool to run some experiments because our bodies are very similar, which I didn't notice until recently and when he was trying to do his mass gain stuff. But it's funny when they grow up here. You never think of them as that big because
I know
they're, like, 16, and you're like, oh, he's a wee lad. He's skinny. Yeah. Should try some milk. It's such you, and then you're like, wait, how do you get taller than me? Oh, I was going to, before we wrap up, I was going to... I saw a picture of Justin just to show you guys that like we are such mentors. I'm starting to think more and more of the gym of OutRun is more like the air temple or something like that people go to. The young kids come to learn their bending. You don't like it? Well, it did get wrecked.
It's because they're vegetarian.
Oh, no, you were about the free-range goats.
Because they had like an entire philosophy around like existence that the air temple has. It's not mine.
Oh, okay.
Well, definitely more. I'm definitely an earthbender, bro.
Oh, you're earth.
I'm earth.
Damn. Okay, real quick, call your bending out.
Oh, if I had to pick one, Earth, hand up.
Not what your personality is, where you think you belong. You think it's Earth. It just happens to be both. That's what you'd want to do, and?
Well, probably because of my personality, but yeah.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, I think it'd be air avoidance.
You're an air guy, huh?
That passive philosophy is definitely more my style. Maybe water. I don't know the water philosophy so much, though.
I don't know if air is necessarily avoidance or adaptation as much as acceptance. And
So avoiding collision, right? Like, whereas earth and fire are very headstrong, I feel like air and water are more avoidance of conflict.
Yeah.
And
channeling.
Yeah, it's like...
redirecting.
I hate using the word go with the flow, but like that's how they're finding the path of least resistance.
Be the leaf.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cool. I go back and forth between fire and water. I know that's weird, but it's just like I have those two like polar opposites. Like I'm always like fighting against ambition. And when I'm outside of that mode, I'm in like something that's more like chill and kind of less resistance, more go with the flow. But then like when ambition kicks in, I'm just like fire, fire, fire.
Yep. That sounds about right.
More like water.
Water. Okay, I was just like, extreme chill or extreme fire. That's just where I like hang out. Some people might call that bipolar, but I'm not bipolar. So, so yeah.
All right. Well, anyways, we got sidetracked a little bit.
Oh, so I guess we'll end this with, I remember that the story I was talking about where do they come to the, what's the equivalent of the air temples for kids to train earthbending?
The forest.
It's like, build your house.
Bossing's day.
Survive.
Survive. Right, anyway. Okay. Was that there was this picture I ran across when I was trying to compile some stuff for some of the culture things we're working on to present our culture to coaches and later staff, probably the rest of staff. It's got Justin hanging on a bar and there's like five kids next to him hanging. And no one's feet are touching the ground. And I looked at him and I was like, wait, of these six people, only one of them still doesn't touch the ground with their feet.
Yep.
Because the rest of them is all grown up. Yeah. And now they're just like, so it's such a crazy, like, I'd love to do another picture where he's hanging from the bars, but like all the reverse. Kids are like,
yes.
Yeah, touching, but Justin's not. Just to show that like we're there, you know, for them as they get older. And there is something that may take a while to like come around and realize about that as a coach. But I think that you have to acknowledge, you know, aside from their parents, we're probably the most persistent figures for kids who stay here for 3 to 5 years.
Yeah.
Because they're going to lose teachers annually.
Yep.
It's true.
Yeah, it's pretty big. Yeah, I still remember my martial art instructors. One of them started us on flips. So, yeah, you have a great effect for sure.
It's true. It's pretty powerful.
Mm-hmm.
For positive or negative.
For positive or negative.
It's true. But all right. So, I know that my like, free gain exercise is absolutely back squat.
Yeah.
That's the one that I would give to parkour athletes. And you could, you know, deviate from there into like high bar, low bar, front squat, overhead squat, single arm, split squat. I know there are a couple of people in the parkour world right now that are all about split squat.
All about split
squat. We've actually had a discussion about this, about like split squat versus standard, like, you know,
oh, we did
double leg squat, yes.
versus back squat, split squat versus back squat.
Yeah, so like if you were trying to get better, like which one? So maybe we could dig in on that on a later one. But
give me a parkour technique. So no. You would go with back squat over split squat.
I would go with back squat because the math is in your favor.
Just I'm not gonna argue why. Just get this for chronological purposes. Just give me the strength free gain and the technique free gain. For parkour.
Technique free gain, I don't really have one for that, but absolutely for strength and power, high bar back squat. It's your nice middle of the road. If you have the range of motion and already have the experience doing it, then the snatch lift.
Okay. Would you say there's a technique in parkour that you would tell athletes that you don't see them working right now that maybe they should spend more time on?
No, I try not to tell other athletes what technical skills they should work on.
He's trying to keep them for himself. He's got secrets. He won't let them out of the bag. That's what it is. That's all right. You know, we're making proclamations here about about Jesse's ability. He's not gonna tell you what he trains on. Like, where does Goku train? What's that?
King Kai's planet.
In King Kai's planet, he doesn't want to tell you what happens in that in that room.
Ooh, can't wait for that. I think so. Benny will get you there. For strength, yep. it'd be back squat. Although I do like front squat. I don't know why I find it comfortable, but I do. If I had to choose one, it'd just be back squat for strength. And broad jumps and plyos and strides and such. For techniques on flips, I have a hard time overcoming the hurdle step, gather step, split step, whatever your sport calls it. Mm-hmm. That one, I think, is just so widely used in a bunch of different techniques. But then in terms of flips, the Ben Jenks concept, the Ben Jenks theory, where flips are a matter of your hips rotating around your upper body rather than what I feel like is the most common perception, whereas your upper body rotates around your hips.
It gets spun around your hips. I think
really once cool. You can understand that concept, and you can understand it in side flip or front flip. So it's like you just need to tackle one of those concepts, and then that your free games will be understanding flips in a variety of different ways. Uh-huh. So that would be my technique one.
Free game. We did say I will say the split squat for free gains on the lifting side, just for parkour people.
Yeah.
And to just like create some sort of friction between our ideas. Yeah. Because then podcast is not interesting if we all agree on everything. That being said, yeah. So I would say split squat. And I had a little video that I made on that just recently for pointed at parkour people.
On TikTok?
I haven't put it out on TikTok. I might have to shorten it to get it on TikTok. But I think I'm just going to drop it on YouTube, and then you can hear some of my reasoning there. But I think for technique-wise, I think that the sort of like eagle-falcon arm reset thing is something that I think you only see it in very high-level athletes, and it's something that is a finesse that sort of just comes from the nature of understanding the movement. And it should be taught at a beginner stage, even though most people think it's unnecessary because the jumps aren't that big, right? Mm-hmm. So those are the goodies I would give.
Cool. Well, if you listeners have any free gains that you've discovered or that you just know about,
they won't give them up. They're greedy.
Maybe. Share them a little bit, you know.
Yeah.
We'll share. Do a little share. We've been sharing with you.
Right, exactly.
Give a little share with us.
We share, you share.
Yeah, it's a conversation. Well, thanks for tuning in. You can watch us on YouTube, see our pretty faces, as well as our facility. And as we move to the new spot, we'll also be doing the same filming, so you actually get to see our cool studio.
Maybe next
That's
time
not
we'll
happening
talk about studio.
For a little while, obviously. But if you if you've been a longtime listener and not a watcher, come the new year, might be time to start watching a couple episodes just to see if we pop into the new studio or when we pop into the new studio. We'll have a whole episode on that. If you're a watcher and you want to listen, we're on all your major favorite podcast platforms. So you can check us out on the go, in the car, while running, while doing back squats, or while training, parkour stuff. I like my AirPods. They stay in while I'm jumping around. So works out well.
Just lost mine.
Oh, yeah. He's got to buy new ones. It was expected. Thanks for tuning in, guys. We will catch you next time. See ya.
Peace.